Case number 215011, Sheet Metal Workers Health and Welfare Fund of North Carolina versus the Law Office of Michael A. DeMeo. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. The appellant will have 10 minutes total, and the amicus filer will have 5 minutes. Mr. Wall, you may proceed for the appellant.
We'll give you a few minutes to get settled since we're operating a little in unusual circumstances due to COVID. Right.
Understood that that was the position of the law firm, then we in the reply brief, yes, we
But you didn't raise it in your, so the district court did not apply the test that you wanted them to apply, the lowest intermediate balance test. Then you filed a motion for reconsideration, and you again didn't ask the district court to apply the lowest intermediate balance test, right? So why not?
Well, based on the court's decision, we thought that the change in the law that motivated the motion for reconsideration was the Zerbel decision, which from the Sixth Circuit, which was not specifically about the lowest intermediate balance test. It was about commingling and whether commingling is enough to destroy an equitable lien. So because that was the specific development in the law after the district court's decision, that was the thing we brought to the district court's attention in the motion for reconsideration. So we do want to go back and rehash the issues that had already been briefed. That's not usually what you're supposed to do in a motion for reconsideration, but something had changed in the law after that, and we wanted to bring that to the district court's attention.
But basically, the way you approached all of this, you never brought it up at a time in the summary judgment proceedings where the other side would have an opportunity to counter it. Did you?
Well, it wasn't the reply brief, so the briefing is closed, that's true. And the court will decide who had the burden on that issue. From our point of view, under all these Sixth Circuit cases we've cited and others, if the law firm, as the defendant, wanted to argue that it dissipated money out of a commingled account, and the law firm itself was saying that it commingled the settlement money with a lien on it with the law firm's personal assets, we believe the law says pretty clearly that the burden shifts to the defendant in order to sort that out.
These are the confusion of goods doctrine cases.
That's right.
So have you cited any cases in the last 70 years, 30 years that apply this doctrine?
No, I think there's something to talk about, but it's not unusual in an ERISA case under 502A3 to be citing old cases because the Supreme Court's
told
me.
It just seems to me that rule applies when there's things are not fungible. So money's pretty fungible, right? So I'm not sure why it matters. If you're holding $10,000, I don't care which specific bills you have or which you know, as opposed to something that's less fungible. My clerks came up with the idea of gold coins. If there's specific coins you think are yours versus coins that were given to the holder by someone else, you want those specific coins. But in this context, I don't know why that same rationale applies if the money is pretty fungible. I mean, the actual dollars themselves.
Well, the fungibility of the money is why there is a lowest intermediate balance test, because there has to be some sort of legal mechanism for figuring out this issue. But the reasons why this court has given for putting the burden on the defendant in this situation of commingling are twofold, and those are in the Smith versus Motley case, and I think the Rossman case we've cited. But basically, they're these. First, the trustee, or in this case, the constructive trustee, and I see my time has elapsed, but I can answer your question, Judge Radler. First, the trustee is not supposed to be commingling the money. And so if the trustee, constructive trustee, is doing that, then it's appropriate to put the burden on the party that did something it wasn't supposed to sort that mess out. The second reason is that it's easier, relatively, for the defendant that commingled the money to produce the information to clear up, you know, what certain funds belong to the trust beneficiary versus the defendant.
Suppose you thought it was your burden. Is there evidence in the record that would establish that the balance item never went below 7,500, whatever the number is, or went below zero?
Yes, there's not conclusive evidence, but there is evidence. And so regardless of
not conclusive evidence, is the best case scenario for you a remand to the district court?
Well, certainly we think at a minimum it should be remanded for the district court to apply the correct test. I don't think there's any dispute on appeal that this lowest intermediate balance test is the correct standard. And summary judgment was not decided under this standard. But to answer your question, Judge Raymer, yes, there is some evidence. If you look at when the commingling happened, which is December 7, 2018, $10,000 of settlement money was put into the operating account, but that was part of about $90,000 in deposits put in the operating account that day. That's a pretty healthy balance in the account to start off with. And Mr. Mayo said in his declaration that those settlement monies were commingled immediately with other funds in the operating account. So that means it didn't have a negative balance at that time, it had a positive balance. 3 months later, the law firm agrees to the entry of that order that requires it to maintain enough money and the operating account to fully satisfy the lien. I think the only reasonable inference from that is that the law firm knew that it already had enough money in the operating account to satisfy the lien. Otherwise, it would be in contempt as soon as the order was entered. So we kind of have bookends in this 3-month period, which is relatively short. You got a positive balance at the beginning, positive balance at the end,
section heading in the argument section, and it reads as follows. Because all traceable funds have been dissipated, there is no remedy under ERISA. It is in bold, it is the only section heading. They were clearly challenged to show that dissipation had not occurred. The only case cited is Montanile. The issue of dissipation was squarely before the court. So the notion that there was no cause or need to bring up all of the arguments and law in support of their position that the funds had not been dissipated is simply not borne out by the record. This issue was clearly presented. Now, turning back to the failure of proof issue, it's worth emphasizing here that ERISA is a statute.
Maybe stay on that issue for a second. So I think the best argument for your friend on the other side is that the Lozner Media Balance test was just an additional argument or additional theory or support for their main argument, which was equitable lien here, and they're entitled to the full $7,000+. And that one argument's part of that claim or that theory was that there's a means for tracing this money in this Lozner Media Balance test. So this was not a freestanding claim, but just a theory or support for what everyone knew was a dispute, which is whether you had money, whether there was an equitable lien attached.
There is no dispute that there is some eight line of cases in the Sixth Circuit that uses the language of so long as the claim is presented, you can subject arguments. But there is also an equally long line of cases, including one that a line of cases applied by this panel on another case as a part of this matter, the Rutland case, where an opinion was issued earlier this week or last week, that states that a party, or on appeal, the role of this court is to review the case presented to the district court, not a better case that is fashioned after an unfavorable ruling. That's language that's used throughout Sixth Circuit jurisprudence. It's certainly used in the Thomas Cooley case that's cited by the parties. And regardless of the language about claims and arguments, what those cases, the Leonor case, the Mills case, the Reed case, they do not allow an appellant to do what the appellant is seeking to do here. Those are not cases where any argument in support of a cause of action can be raised on appeal. What those cases stand for is
It was raised in the district court. I mean, it's a different world if they don't say anybody in all district court. And it was maybe raised at a little later time in district court, but you would agree that Lozner Media Balance test was at least mentioned below.
It was mentioned in the reply brief, but to a point you made earlier, Judge Redler, there was no opportunity for the law firm to come back and rebut that argument. There was no opportunity.
It's a great point. I think it was one of my colleagues.
I apologize.
Made the point. But why isn't a remand appropriate here then?
Because the burden to prove that there was a disputed issue of fact regarding the existence of an equitable lien was on the plaintiff. To carry that burden, they needed to have evidence that the balance never dropped below.
Well, there's sort of this legal question about what the test is, and there's the actual question of whether the test was met. And the district court maybe didn't quite get the right answer on the legal question, or maybe wasn't quite presented the right way. But if we answer that legal question, it seems like that factual question wasn't maybe delved into fully because the legal question wasn't properly addressed or teed up.
Well, to the extent the legal question was not properly addressed or teed up, that failure falls on the plaintiff, the appellant in this case. They had the burden of showing that they were seeking equitable relief, and they failed to do that. If they wanted the court to apply a certain test, they could have brought that up. I will also note, it is not necessarily, and this issue was not briefed below because it was not brought up until the very final filing on any issue related to summary judgment, but it is not necessarily the only equitable test is this lower community balance test. In fact, the courts of equity applied something called the Rule of Clayton's case prior to the existence of the lowest intermediate balance test, which was a first-in, first-out doctrine. Under that test, which again, the issue
never raised below. There was never a challenge made to the law firm. You have a duty to come forward and show that we can't satisfy an element of our claim. That issue was never raised. And we don't know what would have happened if it had been, but it wasn't.
So I thought the problem, I thought that, you know, the best case scenario for a friend on the other side is they presented this lowest intermediate balance test and they had at least some evidence, and you could infer that the amount was always above 7,500, whatever the number is. But the district court didn't apply that test, didn't apply that legal test, didn't apply the lowest intermediate balance test. So it didn't even really get to the construct that the fund was putting forward, which is you do this test and then here's the evidence. The district court didn't even apply that test.
But it couldn't have applied the test on the record, but ultimately the fundamental holding of the district court.
But that's not what it did. I mean, you're right. It's just sort of an alternative basis for, in my mind, it's almost an alternative basis for affirmance, which is even if it applied the right test, there was no evidence that there. So you're saying the district court did it right, even if the district court did it wrong. If it applied the different test, still there was not enough evidence to find for the plaintiff in that sense.
Yes, this is fundamentally a failure of proof case. The issue of what test should be applied is a subsidiary, and that's our position. But whichever test you should apply, the burden is on the plaintiff to prove that they fall within narrow grounds for recovery under ERISA. There's certainly no case that I'm aware of in any circuit saying that under ERISA the burden shifts at some point with commingling. There's plenty of cases that we've cited, both within the circuit and without. Say as a general matter, the burden is on the plaintiff to show that they can claim relief under Section 502A3. And the district court stated, without explaining the test or without explaining the rationale, the funds were certainly dissipated. But continued, the plaintiffs have not shown otherwise. And then in the order on the motion for reconsideration, the district court clarified, really that's the fundamental holding here. There was not proof to show that any funds to which any money to which the fund had an equitable lien remained in the possession of the law firm. And because that is an element of a claim under Section 502A3, no matter what test is applied, summary judgment was appropriate, and so it should be affirmed.
Is it you're saying it's not your burden of proof, but is it your position that your fund went below either zero or $7,500?
I do not know the answer to that. My position in the record is completely silent on it. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll yield the room.
I would say everyone's defense, including the district court, this is a hard case because these are pretty archaic doctrines that everyone's being asked to sort of apply. So does it cut out of the way? If the district judge is listening to this case, this is a challenging one to, I think, hear given sort of the uncertainty in the case law.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I believe you reserved some time for rebuttal.
3 minutes.
On the forfeiture issue, I would agree with my friend that dissipation was at issue in summary judgment. I don't deny that. What was not clear to us in summary judgment until later in the briefing was that they were arguing, yes, they had the money at the time of summary judgment, but maybe it was dissipated sometime before the entry of that agreed order. I think when we realized that that was going to be the focus of the dispute, that's when we understood that we needed to present this lowest intermediate balance test. I regret that it wasn't brought up earlier than that, but we responded to the arguments as best we understood them as the briefing progressed. And I do want to point out with this, at least in the briefing, there hasn't been any dispute in this appeal that the lowest intermediate balance test is the applicable test. This is the first I've heard about a Clayton's case standard or an alternative standard. But in the briefing, at least, you know, the secretary and my client, you know, cited authorities for this test, and the law firm did not dispute that the lowest intermediate balance test would be the correct test for this situation. So I think applying a forfeiture rule, when we did bring it to the district court's attention, under these circumstances would be rather strict, given that there's really not a dispute in the briefs about whether it's the correct test. We think that, at a minimum, the court should just remand it to the district court to apply the correct test in the first instance. And that would be easy to do. If the law firm doesn't want to present the one bank statement showing that its account went to zero, we can just subpoena that to trial. And I think this could be easily resolved under the correct standard with a remand. With regard to the record, we're not asking the court to assume that the account balance stayed positive every day in that 3-month period. But at least in the fund's capacity as a non-movement, as the party responding to the law firm's summary judgment motion, reasonable inferences, all of them need to be drawn in my client's favor. And the only evidence in the record pointing toward the operating account balance being positive or negative points to it being positive. And so there's no evidence brought up in the briefs or oral argument that would suggest that the operating account balance went to $0. Their main account funding the law firm would have to go to $0 or negative to extinguish this lien. That would be kind of an extraordinary thing to happen for a law firm that's a going concern and has not filed for bankruptcy. And so we think it would be unreasonable to infer that that happened and should certainly be just sorted out by the district court on remand. So to conclude, there really is no serious dispute in the briefs in this appeal about what the correct standard is for the case. The district court should have an opportunity to apply that, and that should be a simple matter. One way or another, the law firm can present its bank statements, three or four of them from this short period of time, where we can subpoena them, and then we'll know that we've gotten the correct result in this case. And the court can clarify the legal standard for future ERISA cases, because funds bring a lot of suits like this, and it's important to have the legal standard.